This is Law and Disorder.
Today we'll discuss a recent victory in the post-9/11 backlash fight. A woman allowed to wear her headscarf at her job.
This is a real shocker. She wanted to wear an Alamo headscarf from the company she worked for during Ramadan. They wouldn't let her. They said you might be able to wear it in the back room. Incredible. Four of us who are lawyers couldn't believe the story. You won't believe it either when you hear it, but she won.
And another reason to celebrate a recent victory in the post-9/11 Roundup fight.
You all remember what happened after 9/11. Muslim non-citizens rounded up, disappeared, and sometimes beaten. This case tells the government you can't do this anymore.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Since 9/11, we've seen enormous outbursts of racial bias and religious bias against Muslims, Arabs, and South Asians across the country. Recently, a federal jury in Phoenix awarded more than $280,000 in a religious discrimination suit against Alamo Car Rental. The suit was brought by the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and charged that Alamo Rental committed post-9/11 backlash discrimination based on religion. The case involved Balan Noor, a Muslim woman of Somali descent who was fired from her customer service position in December 2001 after she refused to take off her headscarf. With us today, we have Balan Noor's attorney, Valerie Meyer.
Attorney Valerie Meyer, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Where are you, out in Phoenix?
Yes, we're out in Phoenix, Arizona.
And you work for the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission.
I do. We're in the Phoenix District Office.
And we want to congratulate you on this excellent victory you had on behalf of a Somali woman, Balan Noor, who was fired from her job at Alamo Car Rental because of her religious belief. She was wearing a headscarf, and they told her she couldn't wear it. She wanted to wear it, and they got rid of her. You got them scolded and fined, really, $280-some thousand. Congratulations.
Thank you. We were very, very pleased with the victory.
Can you tell us something about what happened to her and how did you get the case? And I'm also interested in how come the company didn't settle on it and let it go to trial. But let's start with what happened to her.
Well, as you mentioned, Ms. Noor is a Muslim woman and she wanted to wear her headscarf. I think one of the key facts in this case is that she wanted to wear her headscarf during Ramadan in 2001, which started in mid-November. So it was really within 2 months or so of the September 11th attacks. She went in advance to one of her supervisors and said, look, I've worn my scarf the last 2 years without any problems, but out of respect for the company and for our customers, I want to let you know that I'm planning on wearing my scarf again this year.
And what is the significance of wearing a scarf at the time of Ramadan? Really, what's the significance of Ramadan for Muslim people?
Well, you know, I think with any religious belief, it's an intensely personal situation, and Ms. Noor certainly could better address its meaning to her, but it's my understanding that it's a sign of humility and respect before God to cover your hair during Ramadan, which is such a holy month in the Muslim faith.
Okay, so we left you off. She went to her supervisor and told the supervisor, out of respect for the company, I want to inform you that I'm going to wear a headscarf during Ramadan. And what happened then?
Well, this is a couple weeks before Ramadan starts, and her supervisor says, you know what, I'm going to have to get back to you. So he goes to the regional human resources manager, who actually handled human resources for 13 states for Alamo, so, you know, somebody who's fairly high up in the company. And they come back and they say, well, we'll let you wear your scarf, but only in the back room, out of the sight of customers.
What was, did they give a reason for that?
You've got to admire the courage.
Well, you know, I don't know that they gave her a reason. The reason that they have since given is that, you know, if we let you violate our dress code, which it was their contention that, that her wearing a scarf did violate their dress code, then, you know, everyone else is going to want to violate it, too.
Violate the dress code. I'm interested. They had a dress code that wearing a headscarf violates?
Well, I mean, that is certainly one of the issues that has been in dispute. They do have a dress code that is called the Dress Smart Policy. It's pretty specific in terms of what it allows Alamo's employees to wear. I mean, they have, you can wear this color nail polish, but not this color nail polish. You can wear this many earrings. And their contention all along has been that a provision of the dress code that says you can only wear approved uniform items while you're at work is what Ms. Noor was violating. But if you look at the dress code, it specifically mentions the Alamo scarf. Now, the Alamo scarf is a scarf that, as you can imagine, says Alamo all over it. It's a company-issued scarf.
You can wear that scarf.
Yeah, and she actually asked if she could wear that scarf.
Really? What'd they say?
They said no. They said that wearing the Alamo scarf in the manner that Ms. Noor wanted to wear it to cover her hair still violated the dress code. They said that the only permissible use of the Alamo scarf under the policy, and now mind you, the policy does not say this, but that the only permissible use of that Alamo scarf is to cover hairpins or to wear it around your neck, sort of kerchief style.
I can tell you, Attorney Valerie Meyer, for those who just tuned in, we're speaking to a wonderful attorney. Michael and I are smiling here for what you were able to do to Alamo.
Let me stay on this as two lawyers you have here. I'm not sure how much our listeners will be interested. But let's say there was a Jewish person who wanted to wear a yarmulke.
It was my question.
What would have happened?
An Alamo yarmulke.
Well, you know, in fact, we actually have had a very similar case to that out of the Phoenix District office several years ago. We had a young teenage employee working at a Blockbuster video store, and he wanted to wear his yarmulke to work, and they wouldn't let him. We were able to get a positive resolution in that case that actually involved Blockbuster changing its policy so that it specifically mentioned that the dress code applies, but there are religious exceptions.
I can't believe it.
So let's get you back to this case now. So they don't let her wear the headscarf. What happens next?
Well, you know, they say that she, I think an important thing is they say you can wear the headscarf only in the back room, but they're still making her work out at the counter with customers.
No, it's outrageous. That's not acceptable, obviously.
Right. Obviously, any kind of accommodation for religion needs to resolve the conflict between whatever the work practice is and whatever the religious practice is in order for it to be a reasonable accommodation. Ms. Noor comes to work during Ramadan with the scarf on, and she is sent home on December 1st. She comes back on December 2nd. She's again warned, told to take the scarf off, and she's wearing the Alamo scarf at all of these times. She is, on December 3rd, she comes in for the third time wearing the scarf. On the 3rd, she is actually suspended and sent home. She's suspended for 3 days and told to come back December 6th for a meeting with the manager. When she comes back on December 6th, she's summarily fired.
Wow.
And one thing that I did not mention in this whole progression was that after she had initially been told by her manager that she was only going to be allowed to wear the scarf while working in the back office, she actually went to her manager and really tried to find a way to keep her job while being able to observe, you know, her religious practices. She asked if she could take leave of absence. She asked, you know, if she couldn't just continue wearing the Alamo scarf. She really wanted to keep her job. She loved her job. And at the time all of this was going on, it's already, you know, December 1st by the time she's worn for the first time. Ramadan ended in mid-December. So we were talking about a period of about 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's completely amazing because here it's an Alamo scarf. And they wouldn't let her wear that. It makes you think that there's really whatever the reasons they ultimately gave, but that there's a religious animus of some sort underneath
an extraordinary amount of racism, right, and an extraordinary lack of courage on the part of the executives at Alamo, because this must have gone all the way up to the top. And to the extent where you had to not only sue, sometimes Michael and I'll start a lawsuit and they'll settle, but you had to proceed even past filing the suit, didn't you?
Absolutely. In this case, the trial that we had was limited to damages. So it was limited to deciding what amount Alamo was going to have to pay.
How did that happen? They conceded liability?
They, of course, did not concede liability. Judge Roslyn Silver, who was the judge that heard this case.
Oh, no wonder.
She actually ruled on the EEOC's motion for partial summary judgment and found on that motion that it was a violation of Title VII, it was a violation of federal anti-discrimination law for Alamo to have done what it did. So the issue of liability was resolved on summary judgment, which is extremely unusual in these kinds of cases for the facts to be so clearly a violation of the law that the judge does not have to turn that decision over to a jury.
After you won the summary judgment motion, did they come forward with any kind of offer of settlement?
They did not come forward with any sort of reasonable offer of settlement.
How much did they offer?
And I'm not familiar with the figures off the top of my head, but it was a small figure.
Well,
it was certainly nowhere near in the neighborhood of any of the figures that the jury awarded. I know that the jury awarded compensatory damages of $16,000, and if my memory serves me correctly, it was less than that.
And you had punitive. And what was the other $264,000?
$21,640 of that was lost wages that Ms. Noor lost when she wasn't able to find a job for several months after she was fired by Alamo. And the remaining amount is $250,000 in punitive damages, which I think really demonstrates that the public does not want companies to behave this way, and that when they do choose to behave this way, that there are going to be consequences that they're going to pay, both literally and figuratively.
Well, good for you. That's remarkable.
We take our hats off to the jury. The jury is more progressive than the owners of this rotten company.
What was the jury like? What was it made up of?
The jury that we ended up with was seven individuals. And, one of the interesting takeaways from this case was really how important jury selection can be from an attorney's perspective.
No kidding.
We had a prospective jury pool of about 53 jurors, and Judge Silver had actually ordered a jury questionnaire to be sent out that was very comprehensive and was filled out by each of these prospective jurors. What came back on these jury questionnaires was both in some ways encouraging and in other ways extremely discouraging, because we had about 20 of those 53 jurors who had to be excused for cause. That is, they gave answers on the jury questionnaire that demonstrated that they couldn't be fair and impartial because of the issues in this case. Specifically, it involved a Muslim woman who wanted a religious accommodation. We had comments on these questionnaires like, Muslims should not be in this country, they should go home.
Wow.
20 people out of 53 making those kinds
of
comments.
Oh, my heavens.
So it was, the jury we ended up with was great. But I think the lesson is that, especially in more conservative areas, it's really key to get as much information about the jurors in advance as possible.
What kind of jurors were you looking for, Valerie?
I think we were just looking for jurors who would understand that the religious accommodations of provisions of federal law are not just for people of a particular faith. They're not just for Christians. They're not just for Muslims, that really this is an issue about everybody's right to religious accommodation in the workplace, and people who could sort of see past the fact that Ms. Noor is Muslim and look to how sincerely she held her beliefs and the fact that what Alamo did was wrong.
I have a question about what happened to Alamo now on their policy. Have they changed it? Is it the same? I mean, are they just looking at this as an aberration and they're... What have they done with their written policy?
Well, the commission has actually filed a post-judgment motion seeking injunctive relief. This is a slightly unusual situation in that the Alamo that you currently see operating in airports around the country, that Alamo is actually owned by a different company than the one that owned Alamo at the time Ms. Noor was fired. So in terms of injunctive relief, we're attempting to get policy changes, training, all of the things that they did not have at the time of these incidents. But because it's a successor company, it's a little bit trickier.
To what do you attribute the hostility of the 20 people who signed the questionnaires that you couldn't use in the jury?
One of the things that we consistently noticed that the people who were excused for cause had also checked on their questionnaire was that they did not personally know any Muslims. And I think that that actually reflects two separate things. I think first it reflects the idea that you can know who is Muslim just by looking at them, by their appearance. And I think that it also reflects the idea that familiarity actually contributes to understanding rather than the phrase familiarity breeds contempt.
Well, how many years have you been with the EEOC, Valerie?
I've been with the EEOC about 2 years.
This is extraordinary. I have to congratulate you. I mean, I've rarely heard such an interesting, good story.
Yeah. You know, thank you very much to continue the good fight.
And we'll talk to Ms. Noor in a few minutes.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Amazing. Take it easy, Valerie.
Okay.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
We're also joined by Balan Noor.
Balan, congratulations for your courage in getting this victory out there, because it helps everybody. And we were really proud to learn from your attorney what you did.
Yeah, we already know that you even offered to wear an Alamo headscarf, and they wouldn't accept that, which to me was, you know, an utter shock. But first, I have a question about how did you feel going through this process with Alamo? I mean, when they wouldn't let you wear the headscarf, I mean, how did you retain your composure? I mean,
I just felt helpless, and I was emotionally hurt. I never thought that something like this could have happened in the United States, because I was from Somalia, and to me, coming to the United States was just, you know, dream come true country, you know, on happening here. I felt inferior. I felt that I was disrespected, because everybody has religion, and I do respect other people's, you know, religions, and I knew it was against cabinet policy, and it wasn't against cabinet policy to discriminate somebody against the religion. This is protected by the Statue of Liberty. You know, we have a freedom of religion. I felt bad, is what I felt.
And how were you able, like, you know, this took a long time. This happened in December 2001. You got your verdict when? Just how long ago was the actual victory?
The June 1st, yeah.
So how did that make you feel?
It made me feel great, because I did this because this wouldn't happen to somebody else in any other religion, and one should never sacrifice their religion for a job. To me, faith is very important. It's what keeps us alive and what keeps us who we are. It took a while, but I was motivated by it. I knew, to me, the principle was what was the main goal, the principle, not about, you know.
The incident happened shortly after September 11, 2001, and it's taken all this time for a conclusion to the case to be reached. Meanwhile, so much has happened around the country impacting Muslims and discrimination against Arabs, South Asians, and Muslims. because of 9/11. Can you talk about how this case, for you, fit into the context of that larger discrimination?
Because I have worked 2 years prior to 9/11 at Alamo, and never had any problems wearing my scarf. As a matter of fact, I would wear different colors scarf that I bought, not the Alamo scarf. And after September 11th, all of a sudden, the manager approached and said, "You can't, you can't cover your hair, period." And I said, "Why?" I gave him many options that I could even take leave of absence or work in the back office, though I felt kind of inferior still. And even offered him to wear Alamo's scarf. And he said, "No, you can't. It's against company's policy, and you have to remove when you see customers." Kind of felt, why now, not before, you know?
Tell me about in your community. I don't know what your community is. I don't know how many Somalis live in Phoenix. But in the community, were they supportive of your going to court and litigating against Alamo?
Oh, yeah. They were all supportive. They were behind me. They knew, I know, to us, the religion, we practice religion. Important, and everybody practiced their religion, and everybody, you know, they were supportive and helpful, and they knew what I was doing was the right thing.
Did you encounter people who felt like what you were doing was the wrong thing, that after September 11th, maybe you should behave differently?
No, because what I was doing was the right, regardless of the religion, regardless of what happened, and they see me as a person, not somebody from a member of that, and I shouldn't be, you know, judge just because I'm from that community or we share the same religious, you know. That doesn't mean I am a member of them. I live in this country, same as, you know, citizen, and, you know, I should have the same rights as other people.
Yeah, this is similar to the Nishayla Hearn case out of Oklahoma, where a 13-year-old girl wanted to wear the hijab, the headscarf. She started wearing it, and she wore it for a short period of time without incident. And then shortly after the anniversary of September 11th, mm-hmm. I believe it was 2004, she was called, or actually on September 11th, in the anniversary, she was called into the principal's office and told she couldn't wear it. And that little girl fought and won the right to wear this. Did you see similar incidents around the country of other people fighting for their right to practice their religion after September 11th?
Oh, yes. Yes, I have. Yes, I have heard, and I have heard. I've read articles about people having the same, going through the same problems I have, and people not giving up, because you never want to give up. You know it's your right, and you want to fight, and see, because it's justice. This country is about justice, you know.
We're speaking to Bilan Nur, for those listeners who's just tuned in, who won a magnificent victory out in Arizona for the right of freedom of religious expression. Bilan, I wanted to ask you a personal question. What does it mean for a Muslim woman to wear, what's the symbolism of wearing a headscarf, particularly during Ramadan?
Well, you always wear a scarf. It's a symbol of identifying, being. It's a manifestation. It's one of. It's part of the Islamic element. Women should cover her hair, you know, that's how she should be identified. And month of Ramadan, we, like I said, always cover your hair regardless, but the month of Ramadan is a sacred month. It's one of the five elements of Islam, and that month to us is a month of forgiving, a month of charity and kindness. It's like a Easter month, or, you know, things like that, those holidays, and it's, to us, it's very important.
Now, I'm guessing that in your new job, this is not going to be an issue?
No, I don't. Nobody ever had any problems with my scarf at the place that I worked, and even my new job. No, everybody accepts who I am and respects my religion.
So many people after September 11th, so many Muslims have been scared to come out and fight for their rights and have kind of taken it or have gone underground and just been very quiet about it. Can you tell listeners what made you decide to stand up for your rights? And your advice to people maybe who are in similar situations but not fighting back?
I would say never give up. And I have done this. I wanted to do it because nobody should be discriminated against their religion. Nobody should go through what I have been through. And I want to tell people that they can make change to somebody else's life. The reason I did this is I wanted to change somebody else's who was going through the same thing I'm going through, that I had been going through. And they were probably scared, or they think they don't know the laws of this country, and they don't understand maybe English, and they're just thinking, oh, maybe I don't have the right because it's not my country. No, one should never be discriminated. And I want to do it so other people, they don't do it to somebody else who can't talk and speak for themselves. And one should never, ever sacrifice their religion for a job, because your religion is, that's what you believe, and you want to stand up for your right. And this country is about freedom of religion, freedom of speech, everything.
Bilan Noor, thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder, and a big congratulations from all of us.
And congratulations. Well, yes, you're a real hero to all of us.
I thank you so much for interviewing and taking time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, bye-bye. Yeah.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
Recently, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit ruled that former Attorney General John Ashcroft and FBI Director Robert Mueller may be sued for ethnic and religious discrimination after 9/11. Former detainee Javed Iqbal was among the hundreds of Muslims rounded up after 9/11 and held in maximum security conditions. Iqbal, a Pakistani Muslim, was arrested at his Long Island home on November 2, 2001 and was charged with nonviolent federal crimes unrelated to terrorism. 2 months later, he was moved to the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, where he was held in solitary confinement for more than 150 days without a hearing, his lawsuit alleged. The Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan recently recognized that Iqbal had the right not to be subjected to needlessly harsh conditions of confinement, the right to be free from the use of excessive force, and the right not to be subject to ethnic or religious discrimination. Today, we're joined by his attorney, Alex Reinhardt, law professor at Cardozo School of Law. Welcome, Alex, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
So, Alex, it sounds like you had a victory in this case. Tell us about your client and what happened to him.
Well, Mr. Iqbal was here, was working, was here in the United States, had been here for many years, and he was picked up as part of the mass sweeps that we all know were conducted of Muslim immigrant communities shortly after 9/11 and held for more than, as you say, 150 days in solitary confinement under really horrific conditions where he was strip searched multiple times on certain days, where he was strip searched every day on other days, where he was beaten, where he was subjected to verbal abuse, where he really never had any opportunity to challenge the conditions of confinement or even challenge the reason that he was held there. And it was really a nightmare for him. And then he was deported back home to Pakistan, where he lives now.
How did you get in contact with him?
Well, we got in contact with him through our co-counsel, the Urban Justice Center. He had approached the Urban Justice Center, and they approached us, and we've worked with the Urban Justice Center and also the law firm of Weil, Gottschall & Manges on the case. So we've been working with them for several years now on the case.
I'm interested in the issue in the case and what the legal issue is. What was so significant about the Second Circuit ruling?
Well, you know, on one level, what the Second Circuit did was really confirm pretty basic constitutional rights and our ability, all citizens and even non-citizens' ability to challenge conditions imposed in the aftermath of September 11th and to challenge the assertion of executive authority after September 11th. So on some level, I think in part, the significance of the decision rests from the extreme argument that's being made by the executive in these times. In other words, because the executive is making such broad assertions of authority, in this case, they basically said that after September 11th, all these fundamental values of fairness, of equal protection, just didn't exist for our client and for others after September 11th. And the court rejected that. Now, we should embrace the fact that the court rejected it, but I don't think it's a radical ruling. I think it is central to our democracy that even in times of chaos, courts will be available to challenge these kinds of assertions of authority.
Let me ask you something, because I know you're working with the Center for Constitutional Rights on the discovery, and we have a series of companion cases. And I'm trying to remember, we lost in the lower courts on the issue of, and I'm wondering if this came up, that you could, a non-citizen who was out of status could be arrested or detained based on whatever reasons the administration wanted, even if they could decide that we decide after 9/11 we're just going to take out of status Muslims and arrest them or detain them. Now, does this, that seemed like a very nasty ruling to me, and we're on appeal also, but is that what this court said you could not do?
Well, no, this court didn't address the legality of the arrest or the legality of the detention. What this court addressed was the circumstances of the detention once it was effected, right? So it only addressed the conditions of confinement of our client and of clients like the individuals in the Turkmen case.
So the argument is even worse. The argument was that you could essentially treat people more harshly because of their ethnicity or because of the circumstances after 9/11. Is that right?
We're arguing that that's the reason that our client was treated, that Mr. Iqbal was treated more harshly. And the defendant's argument was that in the aftermath of September 11th, there was so much uncertainty and so much chaos that even though there are all these well-established rules that say you can't treat people differently in confinement because of their race or their religion or their national origin, the government was saying, no, you can, because it was so chaotic and such a difficult time for our country.
So the question that's still open is this question on appeal as to whether you can whenever the government decides, they can arrest people based on their ethnicity or detain them based on their ethnicity.
That question is not addressed by the opinion right. in this case, and it will be addressed in the Turkmen case.
Right. Which is,
speaking to this case, can you describe a little bit about the conditions that your client faced?
Certainly. I mean, every day, basically, when he woke up, he was strip searched, no matter whether he had ever left his cell the day before. Every day he was subjected to verbal abuse. Many days he was subjected to physical abuse.
What kinds of physical abuse?
Well, he was on one day in particular in March of 2002, when after he had been strip searched three times in succession, after he'd been strip searched three times in succession, and he asked, "Why am I being strip searched again? You just keep me in this room, strip searching me over and over again." Then he was beaten brutally on that floor, and then he was taken up to the ninth floor where they were housing all of these detainees in the maximum security unit, and he was beaten again when he was up there. He was also in solitary confinement for the entire time that he was on the unit, and you have to imagine that the sense of isolation and fear that he's feeling at this time, when he doesn't have communication with his family, when his lawyer is so afraid of the conditions of confinement that his lawyer won't even visit him in the ADMAC SHU where all the detainees were held.
ADMAC SHU stands for what?
ADMAC SHU stands for Administrative Maximum Security Housing Unit, which was the most secure housing that you could have in the federal system, and that was used for these individuals who were never convicted of anything relating to terrorism. No charges connected to terrorism were even ever brought against Mr. Iqbal, let alone alleged.
Are you, during the discovery period of this lawsuit, going to have a chance to depose Ashcroft or the director of the FBI or even the low-level prison officials that were responsible for these beatings?
Well, discovery has been ongoing in the case, and we have been deposing many of the lower-level correction officers and, in fact, some of the higher-level officers at the MDC, at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. What this ruling allows us to do is take depositions of the very high-level officials like Mr. Ashcroft and Mr. Mueller.
Well, that leads me to my question. I'd like to know what you found out from these low-level people with respect to the beatings. And secondly, what kind of questions do you want to ask Ashcroft and Mueller?
Well, as to the first, I would love to share with you what we found out. Unfortunately, it's all subject to protective order at this point, and I think that's a whole separate issue of the level of secrecy that's being permitted in cases like this to go on. But unfortunately, I'm subject as an officer of the court to the protective order, and so I can't really disclose anything we've learned in discovery at this point.
As soon as you're able to, we want you to come back on the show.
It'd be my pleasure. In terms of the questions that we have for Mr. Ashcroft and Mr. Mueller, I don't want to, in case they're listening, I don't want to give them any heads up. But I think essentially what we're asking for is an explanation as to why our client and clients, why individuals like Mr. Iqbal and Mr. Iqbal himself were subjected to these conditions of confinement when there really was no evidence, at least as so far as we know, to connect them to terrorism and what the justification was. And then we want to be able to challenge that justification in courts.
Was Mr. Iqbal's treatment typical?
Well, Mr. Iqbal's treatment was certainly typical of Muslim and Arab and South Asian detainees who were held in the ADMAC SHU. Yes, I think that's fair to say.
And about how many people after 9/11 were rounded up? How many Muslims rounded up and held there?
In the New York area, hundreds were rounded up. Of those who were held in the high security, approximately between 80 and 100 at any given time. It became lower as they started to release people slowly from the unit.
Now, I remember when these calls came into our office and families couldn't find their husbands or brothers, or Adai, I'm sure, remembers as well. And we would go to one prison, then they'd be in another prison. So it was...
Yes, as we've alleged in the lawsuit, and as the Inspector General of the Department of Justice confirmed in his report of this, there was, for the first few months, just a blackout of communications about these detainees. And even if you were the detainee's lawyer and you showed up, you might not even be told that the detainee was there.
They were essentially disappeared for a period of time. Now, I know when we lawyers at my office visited occasionally, and there were videotapes. And something I know in this case, in the back of my head, there was something about videotaping the lawyers with the clients. Is that something that happened?
I have to be very careful as to, what I talk about. What I know from discovery and what I know from what's in the public record, that allegation has been made in a separate lawsuit that's not connected to our case by legal aid attorneys.
That's right.
And there certainly are a lot of allegations about monitoring of attorney-client communications during this time period.
Did you ever interview your client in the ADMACs, or you got the case later?
We became his attorneys after he was deported.
Some of our attorneys who went in, the guys were brought out in the three-piece suits, you know, the shackling from the wrist to the waist to the feet. And, you know, it was really severe conditions to even see your client.
That's right. They were all, whenever they were moved outside of their cells, they were held in restraints, in both leg restraints, wrist restraints, and what they call a belly chain, which connects a chain around your belly to your wrist, so your movement is severely restricted.
Alex, I wanted to ask you a question about the chain of command here. As we've learned in places like Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, it wasn't just a bunch of rotten apples or hillbillies from the mountains of Maryland. Those orders to torture those people came from the top down. What do you suspect is the situation here with your client and the others who are confined with him?
Well, I have to tell you quite truthfully that this is an open question to me. I mean, I believe that strongly that the high level of government knew that this was going on and approved that this was going on. And certainly the Inspector General's report suggests that that was the case. Now, again, I haven't had the opportunity to ask Mr. Ashcroft or Mr. Mueller questions, haven't had the opportunity to get documents from Mr. Ashcroft and Mr. Mueller, but that, I think, is the heart of the case, what they knew, when they knew it, and what they approved and what they didn't approve. But given the pattern that we've seen in other areas around September 11th and around the enforcement efforts that the executive underwent after September 11th, I wouldn't be surprised at all if it was the case that they knew of and approved all of these conditions. And everything that we've seen, at least in the Inspector General's report, suggests that.
The Inspector General's report you're referring to is one by Fine?
By Glenn Fine, yes.
Shortly after, I mean within 6 months or so
after
his
arrest. Well, tell us about it.
Yeah. Sure. It was, since there were numerous complaints about conditions of confinement coming out of the Metropolitan Detention Center, the Inspector General of the Department of Justice underwent an investigation and interviewed a number of people.
And the Inspector General, folks who don't know, is kind of like an internal watchdog.
Right. So it's supposed to be an independent office, an independent agency that is to report on abuses even within the Department of Justice. The Inspector General released an initial report which documented a number of abuses and also documented all of the communications blackouts that were going on, and also certainly documented that at high levels of the Bureau of Prisons and the Department of, and at the Department of Justice, there were certain policy decisions that were made with respect to these detainees that affected their lives on an everyday basis.
Yeah, one of the things I remember vividly coming out of the at the same time as the Inspector General report was some really vivid images of what was actually going on when, you know, people had no idea for many, many months. One of them was that up on the wall there was a T-shirt hung. I think it had an American flag and an eagle on it, a very aggressive-looking eagle. Everybody's seen the image. And detainees were dragged on their feet and forced into this wall, and the T-shirt actually had bloodstains on it. Other descriptions were of detainees being dragged by their chains so that they would bang into walls and prison cells and, you know, just at a running pace.
Yeah, and you know, our view is that basically the high-level officials created this environment, this really poisonous environment within the MDC, such that our client, Mr. Iqbal, and others like him just were viewed immediately as terrorists and terrorist suspects. And after September 11th in New York City, it's no surprise that if you create that environment and you encourage correction officers to view people like Mr. Iqbal and others as suspected terrorists, that abuses are going to occur. And it's and that doesn't excuse it, but it certainly doesn't excuse the line officers who beat up our client on different occasions, but it also points heavily to the responsibility of the high-level officials who created that environment and allowed it to fester.
Let me go back to Mr. Iqbal's case. Where you won in the Court of Appeals. What happens next?
Well, now we'll continue with discovery against the low-level officials as we have for the past 30-odd weeks, and we'll attempt to get discovery from the high-level officials. I imagine the high-level officials may seek review from the Supreme Court. They may seek review from the full Second Circuit. They have that right.
But it's essentially a damage case that you're trying to get to trial here. Is that right?
It's a damages case because Mr. Iqbal has been deported, we really don't have anything we can ask for other than damages. And we hope that even though in the end what we'll get for Mr. Iqbal will be damages, what we'll get for the law and for future for individuals like Mr. Iqbal is some guarantee that this won't happen again, or at least if it happens again, there'll be an immediate legal response that will stop it in its tracks.
The whole problem of secrecy and executive assertions of secrecy recently is something that we really have to grapple with as a legal community, because courts are allowing it. I think attorneys on both sides are allowing it. It's easier to agree to a secrecy agreement than it is to fight in court to insist that only things that really should be properly designated confidential or secret. So I think it's a real challenge and something we need to think about in the future.
Yeah, I think it's the other side of the coin of the government claiming they've got a right to know everything about everybody. And I totally agree with you. It's really been a qualitative change since 9/11, and something that we continue to cover on the show.
Right. I mean, we have when the individuals showed up at Guantanamo who had been held in the secret prisons, right? The government actually argued initially that they couldn't talk to their lawyers about any of the interrogation techniques that they were subjected to because that the interrogation techniques themselves were government secrets.
Well, we're still there yet. We represent Majid Khan. In fact, that's one of our clients, and we've been trying to get an interview with them, and they claim that we can't because we don't have a high enough classification of security.
And
that includes the interrogation techniques.
Right.
It'll tip off Al-Qaeda what they did to him. Everybody doesn't know he wasn't waterboarded, right?
Right.
In terms of everything that's happened since 9/11, how does this particular case, Mr. Iqbal's case, fit in?
Well, I think it fits in because one of the overriding arguments, I think, that the President Bush and his Department of Justice has been making in the aftermath of September 11th is that all the things that we used to think were well established, all the rights that we used to think we had as citizens or just as residents of this country have to be questioned now in the aftermath of September 11th. And I think our case is one part of challenging that assertion of authority. And it's really a confirmation of the independence of the judiciary, I think, that the Second Circuit was willing to see past that argument and say, well, we recognize that September 11th was a unique occurrence and that there might be certain rights that are context specific, but for the most part, we're talking about well-established rights, fundamental rights that are so important to our democracy that if we sacrifice them at a time of September 11th, then we've really sacrificed what is the heart of our community and our country. And so to me, that's where this case fits in, and that's why it's important.
Mr. Iqbal, how long was he here for before this arrest?
I was here for several years before this arrest.
And where is he now?
And he's now in Pakistan in his home.
And I presume he has a deportation that doesn't allow him to come back to the United States.
That's correct. It doesn't allow him to come back to the United States.
And this is not like he was ever found guilty of anything. It was a visa that was whatever.
Well, he was found guilty of using someone else's Social Security card.
Right.
So he did plead guilty to that.
Essentially an undocumented worker, though.
Alex Reinhart, attorney for Javed Iqbal and professor at Cardozo Law School. Thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much for having
me. Thanks, Alex.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Thank you. all right. It's all right. I think it's for your mama. One beat for the drama. Hey, it's a karma, I say. When things go your way, you say, say, it's all right. It's all right. To me, say, it's all right. Say, it's all right. It's all right. It's all right. I know it's all right. It's all right. Hey, it's all right. I know it's all right.
Wanna move.